In traditional CI/CD, the caching is based on upload and download. The problem with uploads and downloads is that they slow down your build. So your build may oftentimes be slower with cache than without it, which is maybe bonkers if you think about it. Satellites are made such that the cache is local and really fast. So it's instant, there's no download, no upload, and it's also automatic. So you don't have to think about even what to cache and what not to cache.
Hey, before we get started, I'd like to remind you that we have a newsletter now. If you want to get all the latest DevTool news of the week and our post-show reaction to the latest episode, head over to mail.devtools.fm to subscribe. This week, we've also put up some new items in our merch store. The TypeScript t-shirt now comes in multiple shirt weights and a whole bunch of different colors, and we have a tank top too. And with that, let's get on to the episode. Hello, welcome to the DevTools FM podcast. This is a podcast about developer tools and the people who make them. I'm Andrew, and this is my co-host, Justin.
Hey, everyone. We're really excited to have Vlad A. Ilonescu on. Vlad is the founder of Earthly, and we're really excited to talk a little bit more about Earthly. Vlad, you were previously at Google, and you helped co-author a book. Is that true?
Not a book, but the RabbitMQ Erlang client.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah. Exactly. And I was also at VMware, and I also built another company called Shift Left, nowadays called Quiet.ai, Q-W-I-E-T.ai.
Cool, cool. Well, before we sort of dive into more talking about Earthly, you sort of started on your intro. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our audience about yourself?
Yeah, no, I've been in the developer tool space for a while, and I really, really like them. I don't know what's with them that I like so much, but I just like providing help to other fellow engineers. And, you know, it's what makes me wake up in the morning. It's what gets me going.
Yeah, Andrew and I would agree a lot on that. Thus the podcast.
So I guess I want to ask you about your old startup first. What was your first startup?
Yeah, well, there have been many failures until the one I would call the first, but let's talk about the success first, I guess. So before Earthly, I built ShiftLeft with another two co-founders. And ShiftLeft is this code analyzer that evaluates your source code for vulnerabilities and tells you whether you have any before you ship to production. And it does it so much faster and much more accurately than anyone ever could before, because in the world of yesterday, you would leave the code analyzer to run maybe overnight because it would take hours at a time. But now with CI/CD, you actually want it to run really fast. And so that's what we did at ShiftLeft. We delivered on that that particular vision.
That's awesome. What do you think was different about that startup that made it successful as opposed to the previous efforts that you had that were not?
Yeah, well, a lot of it was just me learning how to do startups, you know? So I had many attempts before that, like I was trying to build some sort of marketplace for rental properties, and then I tried to build some serverless framework. And, you know, I think a lot of it was just down to me understanding how a startup should work and how you can build something very meaningful, not focusing not just on the technology, but actually understanding the business as a whole, understanding products and use cases and how to bootstrap your audience and so on. And I think that's maybe the main thing I would say, but also it was the partners I worked with. They were amazing people. They are amazing people. And, it just helped me understand, like, they were mentors to me. It was a really good introduction for me on how to run a company and how to scale a team, how to be a leader. And that kind of mentorship really, really helped. And I would say it was a combination of factors, but mostly experience.
As a person who's like tried to have like various side projects in the past, like I think developers as a whole kind of underestimate the business part of it. It's just like, oh, I just got to make a thing and then I'll have a thing and it'll be successful. And it's like, that's almost like the easy part is making the thing. The hard part is making the thing into a business. And that's what a startup is a business in the end.
I always tell people that the go-to-market part of a company is always the hardest, maybe unless you're building, I don't know, rocket science or, I don't know, self-driving cars or something, it's almost always the go-to-market that is harder than the tech, no matter how complex your tech is.
Yeah, there are aspects of this that are interesting to me that it seems like there's a lot of things that you could sort of fall in love with, you know, we made these tech decisions, or like, oh, you know, this is my vision for the product, or, oh, this is the problem that I think we want to solve. And the interesting thing is it's like, none of that may serve you. You know, you might have to like let go of any one of those things or all of those things at any one given point. And then, you know, importantly, if you got really excited about the problem or the tech or whatever, and that's what motivated you to do the work, and then you have this like mountain of other like really tedious, like, oh, you know, you got to set up a company structure and you got to deal with taxes and you got to do all this other stuff that's like really important to like have a company, you know, it'd be really easy to burn out, you know.
Exactly. So. And I really resonate with what you said there. Like, you start off thinking it's your baby, your product, but the sooner you understand that it's not your product, it's your user's product, and you are basically you're there to serve your users, that's when you actually unlock your full potential. And it's not quite as rosy as it might seem on the outset, and you have to sort of accept that. And it can be fun, you know, it doesn't mean it takes away from the fun, but it's just a different ball game that maybe you're expecting.
So let's move on to talking about the current ball game that you're participating in, Earthly. So what is Earthly, and how does it help me with my builds and my CI?
Yeah, Earthly is a build automation framework, and it helps you with containerizing your builds such that they behave the same way no matter where you run them. So you could run them on your laptop or your colleague's laptop or in CI. And the typical example I give is when you have a CI/CD failure and it's hard for you to understand what exactly went wrong, and you maybe change the script a little bit to try something else, you commit to GitHub all over again, wait for the CI to kick in, wait for it to reinstall dependencies, redownload stuff, eventually gets to minute 23, it fails yet again, and then you're stuck in this little feedback cycle that is very, very slow, and it's extremely time consuming and very annoying, and there are no good ways to deal with that. And for that reason, we built Earthly. It's meant to replace your CI/CD scripts, but not replace your CI. And with that, you are actually able to run your entire CI scripts locally on your laptop with the same consistency as you would get in the CI, and be able to debug things faster, iterate faster, something that you might do, you know, in that feedback cycle of 23 minutes, maybe it's down to 2 minutes now because it's all fast and local. A lot of people use it for that kind of consistency. But another value we deliver is also speed. We have ways in which we can ship your build to a remote runner that we run in our cloud. And it makes it really, really fast through the use of caching. Basically, we understand what has changed and what has not changed as part of your build. And we do not repeat those very redundant sort of activities the CI does in the beginning, like, you know, downloading and installing dependencies. We just have those immediately from cache. And so we skip them. We go straight to the point where you actually made the change, run that, and give you really fast feedback. And we call that product Earthly Satellites. These are remote runners that you could use in conjunction with Earthly or not. You could just run Earthly locally as well if you want to.
We once again want to thank our sponsor, Raycast. Raycast is like Spotlight, but with superpowers. If you've ever thought Spotlight's not doing it for you and you want more out of it, Raycast is for you. It has an amazing extension API and extension store where you can install a bunch of things people have already made. With just one keystroke, you can access so many different things on your computer, whether it's managing what's playing on Spotify to opening VS Code to doing math, Raycast does it better. Another way Raycast helps you do it better is with Raycast Pro. Raycast Pro includes a whole bunch of cool things, but Raycast AI is where it's at. No longer do you have to go to some website or some weird app to access your AI chats. Right from within Raycast, you can get to working. In my own workflow, this has been amazing. If you want to learn more about Raycast, head over to raycast.com, or if you want a deeper dive into what Raycast actually is, go listen to episode 38, where we interview the CEO, Thomas. Do you want to advertise with DevTools FM? Head over to devtools.fm/sponsor to apply.
So there's something really interesting about this. So you said it's like explicitly not CI. It's sort of the mechanisms that your CI can use in like a very reliable way. So I want to talk more about like the mechanisms of that and sort of maybe some of the challenges, because, you know, there are like other CI services. Well, there are CI services that have containerization, you know, options. So I think of like Circle CI, you know, you can do containerization in Circle. Maybe it's not standardized across CI platforms. But before we get into that, you did have a CI service with Earthly that you ended up shutting down. And we were just talking about startups and sort of the challenges with those and, you know, exactly, sort of understanding the product. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and, you know, what the CI service was and how it relates to Earthly and sort of why you ended up changing things up?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started with the vision that your CI should run locally, right? And that simple but very powerful vision, of course, translates into your productivity, being able to debug things locally and so on. But it also, it meant we would have to build a CI. Well, at least that's what we thought originally, right? And so we built this whole system incrementally, starting from the syntax of the CI. And so that's what Earthly is today. And then the remote runners of the CI, I guess the runners, we didn't think they were remote at the time, but the runners of the CI, and those became satellites. And then the different pieces of it, like the caching and the parallelization and so on. So we built these incrementally. We did not ship a CI from day zero, right? And all of these individual pieces, we just put them out there and let people play with them, you know, let people experiment with them. And a bunch of these really interesting components got a lot of traction. And along the way, we were thinking, man, if these individual components are gaining so much momentum, imagine what our full vision will gain. And a lot of people were using these components in CI/CD use cases. And again, that was validation that, okay, a CI is really needed in here. And so after putting all those components together, eventually after many years of, you know, well, 3 years of working on these individual components, we put it out there, and actually there was silence. Nobody, you know, crickets. not many people actually wanted a new CI. And that was pretty surprising to us, given that we were getting all this validation beforehand, and now, you know, crickets afterwards. So we spoke to as many teams as we could. What we gleaned from the situation is that, well, people are really married to their CI/CD solution, and it's really, really hard to go and replace it. And for good reasons. Some of them, some of the features they have are really advanced. These companies have been around for quite a while to build this ecosystem. They have so many more resources than we do as a startup. And so they've invested in plugins and, I don't know, OIDC or, you know, all kinds of advanced features that an MVP like ours would not have. So that was one of the problems. And the other problem was that putting the CI as a product out there, got some people, to trip the, like their alarm bells with, you know, I've tried CIs before and I've tried them all and they just all have different syntax. But ultimately they're all the same. So people just had a really, really strong bias that CIs are undifferentiated. And even though we could then tell them, hey, no, you get all these interesting features as part of that. You can run it on your laptop. You can make it really fast and so on. It just would not shake that initial bias of a CI, you know, being just kind of the same but different syntax. It sounded just like basically like marketing speak, basically. And so after talking to many such companies and failing to get adoption in bigger teams and having the product out there, failing to get some organic adoption either, well, we decided to shut it down. And we did this pretty quickly. Like this was what, maybe 6 months after we released it. So very, very fast. And the reason we did it so quickly is from a lesson I'd learned from Shift Left, actually, because we were just talking about it. So at Shift Left, interestingly, we had this a very kind of similar situation where we had this interesting end vision that was really big and grandiose, And eventually we found out that the individual components of that vision were more valuable than the end product. And so at ShiftLab, we were in, before we were building this code and analyzer tool, we were building actually a runtime agent that is informed from your source code and could protect you from vulnerabilities in your source code automatically without you having to fix them. And that required you to analyze the source code, put it in CI/CD, but also put it in production, in runtimes. And imagine what kind of company would be the target audience for a security product. Of course, the most compliant, the most rigid sort of organizations, the healthcare organizations and the financial organizations of the world. And it was just really, really hard to insert as a product. And it took us, you know, initially we were thinking, okay, it's hard to insert, but if we had this feature and this other feature and this other feature, it would all work. And so we just kept pushing on it, despite getting all these signals that it's not working, it's just too hard to insert. We just worked on it for quite a while, maybe a year longer than we should have. And so one of my biggest regrets with that was that we had the information, but we did not stop. Now going through this cycle again, it's very similar in that the end vision is not as strong as the individual components of the vision that are picking up quite a bit in terms of momentum. And so I'm recognizing the signals. It's not the features that are missing. If you have a very successful product, it will be successful in MVP form too, but at a smaller scale. You will find enthusiasts and early adopters and mavens or whatever you might want to call them. But there's going to be some really early people who are going to take those bugs. They're going to suffer through those bugs, those issues, those missing features, and still use your product and still advocate for it and so on. And we had a couple of them, but never at the scale we wanted to. So we could never get a bigger team to use it. And all of those were just signals to me that, you know, it's not the features that are missing. This is not needed in the form we thought it was needed. So we pulled the plug early and decided to refocus on our other priorities.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense with CI. Like recently we moved at Descript from like half actions, half Azure to all actions, and just the pain of moving like half of the CI into actions was enough to be like, nobody wants to touch this. Nobody wants to have to go through that pain again. So like I can imagine like the big org problem is basically like the people who would benefit from your product most are the big orgs, but the big orgs have the toughest time moving to a new CI platform that might not have all the same features. And then you get into the mixed scenario again, where it's like, oh, part of it kind of runs better over here on Earthly, but then we have all this other stuff that depends on GitHub Actions. So it makes sense how you like had to break it apart.
Yeah, exactly. So now we basically are able to deliver the same value, but without replacing your CI. And this seems to resonate much, much better with our audience. So we kept the, like right now, the runners are remote runners and the syntax is the same as before, right? And these are things that were working even before we had the CI, because we, like I said, you know, we built the components before we had the full vision. And this is much, much easier for people to accept. They don't have to replace everything. They know they can just take this stuff incrementally, put it in the parts of your project where it's the most painful or the most limiting for you with your current setup, and then just unlock value without replacing your CI, essentially. So just drop it exactly where it's needed.
There's an interesting thing here where I think, so there's a few aspects of the business that we're looking at. So from my mind, a CI service is like a very clear, like how you charge for that business is a very well-known thing, because it's like a very well-known product in the market, right? There's a lot of people that are doing this, and it has a huge startup cost, it has a huge transition cost, there's a lot of broad features that people expect, platforms are coming with their own CI and people just like want to use the defaults out of the box. There's like a lot of challenges. So you had to do this pivot where you're like, oh, well, we were going to build a CI service. And I'm sure that meant like you were thinking about like, okay, you know, we're going to charge like teams for seats or something like that. And you're like, well, crap, this isn't going to work anymore. And now we have to figure out, it's like, all right, how do we build a business out of something that is shared across CIs? And, you know, you could, developers are classically hard to sell sometimes because they'll like, you know, guffaw at your like audacity to try to charge for like some scripting thing or something. But, you know, you are in this case. It's like, well, we have to offer a product that people want to buy. These are the components that we know people like. I know you have an open source component, and I'd love to talk more about like what parts of your business are open source. But how did you like, was it clear from the moment that the CI was going to shut down that like, oh, well, we're going to do like a remote runtime, and that will be sort of our sort of clear trajectory to build a business around this tooling? Or did you sort of have to go back to the drawing board? It's like, okay, crap, like, what do we do?
Yeah. Well, luckily, this time around, we did not have to go back to the drawing board because we just built the company so much more incrementally than I did with ShiftLeft. With ShiftLeft, we just didn't imagine that situation happening, you know, having to go back to the drawing board. And so we decomposed after we were done with experimenting. And so we had to sort of start over with many of our efforts. But this time around, we just built everything incrementally and put it out there incrementally. And that helped with gathering user feedback and adjusting the product as we went along. And before we had the CI, satellites were already successful. So that was maybe the main thing. It was very obvious when the CI did not work, it was very obvious that we would go back and focus on what's working actually. Maybe it was difficult for us to accept that we've put some work in CI and we have to let go of that. That's always difficult, but at least it wasn't like a full-on sort of go back to the drawing board kind of thing. And you mentioned something interesting with regards to developers and buying things and so on. There's something my colleague Adam Gordon Bell said, which was really well put, in that developers will buy things, but you can never sell them something. And that is a very interesting way to put it, in that you can never tell a developer, hey, this is my tool, come check it out, you know, come give us money for it. But you can put it out there and wait for the developers to come to you. And that is kind of backwards to what you're taught in sort of go-to-market school, if you will, because that's exactly what you should not be doing. Basically, like, you should not just put the software out there and hope that people will come to it. And so you have to become very creative. You have to offer things to developers for free without necessarily expecting anything in return. And that's why Earthly is open source. And that's why we write a lot of developer-focused content that has nothing to do with Earthly. We just write interesting content. And as we speak, actually, something is on Reddit on number one in R programming right now, like an article of ours. We just keep on hammering these interesting topics that developers like without any expectation of return. And what happens is we build a lot of traffic on our blog. We build a lot of traffic, therefore, on our website. And eventually, people trickle down organically. It seems like we just put it out there and people come. But actually, we've invested a ton in this sort of motion, in this very bottom-up motion. So like right now, we have 2 million visitors per year on our blog. Just from these articles. And we've been very sort of intentional with developing that. But yeah, the other thing about pricing and the way traditional CI/CD has been priced so far, I feel like is very backwards. And we've taken a very opinionated stance around this. So if you think about how the value aligns in CI/CD, you are billed by the compute minute mainly. So of course there is a seat price, but it's very small and it's intentionally small to make you believe it's cheaper than it actually is. The bulk of your budget will go on build minutes. And those build minutes are kind of hard to find actually on the pricing page of the typical CI/CD vendor. The problem with that is that the slower your build is, the more profit the vendor gets from it, which sort of does not correlate with the value that you deliver. You're supposed to deliver developer productivity and make things really fast and so on. And so if you had a feature that would make your build 10x faster as a CI vendor, you'd have to rethink your pricing or maybe not ship that feature. But of course, you would not be very incentivized to do that quite as much. And so we've taken a very different stance with regards to pricing. We said, okay, compute should be billed at cost. We make zero profit from compute. And instead, you will give us more money for the seat. And this will represent a more realistic value of what you actually pay for. So when you look at the pricing page, it's going to be much more real. And we also bake a lot of included minutes such that you don't have to even think about minutes quite as much. You think about individual developers. If we want to deliver productivity to developers, that's the main metric, the main unit of value that we need to be aligned with. And that's why we took that kind of stance. We don't make profit if your builds are slow.
That's huge. I'd never thought of that or really heard of that, but like, you're so right. What would the economic incentive to have like a performance optimization team in a CI company when that like directly reduces the amount of money that comes in? It kind of behooves you to do the opposite. It's like, we'll like be a little less efficient about how we download and we can like bump the numbers.
Exactly. And I'm sure nobody thinks like that in these companies, but you know, capitalism has its way of creating weird incentives in very obscure ways in which they're just hard to notice.
Wow.
Yeah. I had never thought about the pricing thing either. And it just makes so much sense that fast builds don't mix with CI companies. Like, where's the incentive? I remember when Turbo Repo first came out, before it had been bought by Vercel, they were charging based on the time you saved. So it was like the inverse of it.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think we were thinking ourselves to build on something like that. I think that's probably the most precise way in which you can align yourself with the value that you deliver. Sometimes the hard part with that is that it's hard to estimate in advance how much that will be. But you know, I'm sure for many cases that's the most fair way to price it.
I do like your pricing model though, because you know, if you're selling to a large enterprise especially, there's this desire to have like a consistency or like a known quantity. It's like, how much is this going to cost me? Because if you come to like a engineering director or VP of engineering or CTO or something, and they're like, hey, we should use this tool. They're like, okay, what's the cost? And if it's like, you know, like a Lambda or something, it's like, well, it depends. We're not sure yet, but it could be like this to this. And then you have all this work to do around like just calculating projections and, you know, Lord knows if those are wrong, maybe you get like put in the hot seat because it's like, oh, you said this is going to be, you know, $15,000 and we just spent like $50,000 or something like that.
Exactly. I've seen that so many times. It's really hard to estimate compute. Usage-based pricing in general.
Engineers are not good at estimation. I maintain that position.
that too, yeah.
So moving to the service level a little bit, why did you name it Earthly? I'm interested.
Yeah, so Earthly came from this idea of this expression being down to earth, which I really, really liked. This idea that you want to be friendly and accessible. And I think, I guess I learned this from Google. I was kind of surprised when I was meeting people higher and higher up in the hierarchy. Like, the higher they were, the more humble they were. So like, at first I was maybe a bit scared by them. Like, oh man, these are going to be like, you know, these really tough people or whatever. I don't know what I was imagining. But actually it was the complete opposite that I was expecting. And after thinking about it, it made so much sense. You know, like I've learned from the Google culture also that you want to be the serving manager, the kind of manager where you serve your employee, not the other way around, the way it's maybe traditionally portrayed in popular media and so on. And taking this to the next level, I wanted our products to be also friendly and accessible, like, you know, down to earth, friendly and so on, easy to use and easy to learn. And that's why we chose the name Earthly. It's a testament to our internal culture and hopefully to our products as well. to be as easy to use as possible.
Interesting. If I had to guess before you gave me that answer, I would have said it had something to do with the environment and like caching builds and like saving CI costs.
Interesting. Yeah, that is, I hope we're saving the planet in while doing that. And there are some interesting plays we can make in the future regarding that.
So you mentioned Satellite earlier, and Satellite is the name of your runtime?
Yes. Satellites are our remote runners. So these units of computation that are able to execute the builds for you, and they have really, really fast caching. So like that's key. In traditional CI/CD, the caching is based on upload and download. So maybe you get a certain result in your CI, and then you upload your dependencies, or you upload a bunch of intermediate images that you built as part of that, and maybe you can reuse them on the next run. The problem with uploads and downloads is that they slow down your build. So your build may oftentimes be slower with cache than without it, which is maybe bonkers if you think about it. But satellites are made such that the cache is local and really fast. So it's instant. There's no download, no upload, and it's also automatic. So you don't have to think about even what to cache and what not to cache, maybe at least not at a high level. It's just fully understands, you know, the steps in your build and which part depends on which other part in your build. And with that information, it can just automatically derive caching information that you can just instantly use on the next run. And it's always fast regardless. So there's no question about it, kind of like there is with traditional CI. And that's why, you know, it's turned on by default. You cannot, well, there are ways to turn it off, but it's just always there, basically.
So most of the model here is you're actually sidestepping a lot of computation on, if you're running hosted, your hosted solution, you're sidestepping a lot of computation on CIs, whether that's, you know, CI that you're running in a rack at your data center, or CI that you're running from like GitHub Actions or something. You're more like saying, hey, invoke this script or invoke this like earthly thing, whatever you call them. And so invoke this earthly CLI, and then, you know, you have an image or a series of images or something that you want it to run. And then the remote runners in this case are the things going off and doing that work. And I'm assuming that the CI on, you know, whatever your coordinating CI service is really just waiting for a response, and then, you know, kind of continues on.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can still combine other things in that CI. Like, that's the thing that's different about, you know, earthly in screen form and earthly CI that we had before that we were thinking about, is that you can still combine whatever workflows you might have in your current CI. You can still use those in conjunction with earthly. You don't have to say goodbye completely to your current CI. And that helps with, you know, the ecosystem of plugins that GitHub Actions has, or many other such ecosystems have. At the end of the day, we are sort of sidestepping the computation part, and the CI is just waiting there. One thing people do as a result of that is that they use the smallest possible runner size, because they don't do any CPU on it. They don't use memory. They don't use much at all. And just leave the whole thing to earthly satellites to run the build and use the caching and all that. And that seems to be pretty effective. Because of the speed benefits that you get, your CI build always ends up smaller as a result. So your CI bill is what I meant. So you're paying less, and sometimes it's actually you're saving more money than you're paying earthly for it. So that's an interesting thing. You're adding services, but you're saving money at the same time.
That's pretty cool.
So what platforms do these satellites support? Like what systems, and like, are you guys owning that hardware? Or is it like you like coordinate something with AWS? Like how's it all set up?
Yeah, we use AWS underneath, and the satellites are single tenant. So like they're super secure. So you're not sharing any computation with any other customer. We're also smart about turning off those instances where they're not used, so you don't actually pay for things you're not using. That's kind of obvious, but you know, it's an interesting architectural choice. And yeah, the platforms we support are mainly Linux-based, right? And I should say only Linux-based. So anything that goes, that runs on Linux, runs on Earthly, and Earthly containerizes everything, of course, and containers are Linux in the end. So that's why we're tied to this container technology, and containers right now only work on Linux. But we support x86 and ARM64, and you can also run builds, like cross run them. So for example, maybe your laptop is a Apple Silicon and you want to run a build that actually only runs x86 for some reason. And you can run that on satellites natively and still get the result back to your laptop, from that build without having to use emulation. And that is, oftentimes much faster than trying to emulate it locally. And besides that, we're compatible with any CI, and we're compatible with any programming language that runs on Linux, basically. We don't have a ton of opinion that we insert on top of your programming language specific tools that you use. We believe that the creators of those tools have the best experience for that tool, the best package manager, the best compiler, and so on. We don't try to replace that in any way. So maybe other tools like Bazel and such, they do have an opinion. They do want you to replace those, and that becomes very difficult to insert for that reason. We don't have that kind of opinion, and we just make it compatible with anything.
So one more thing on satellites before we move on. One thing I've had problems with in the past with CI is, like, say I want to test like performance or something. Like, it's CI runners, their performance is very variable. You might get one that's like great, you might get one that's not so great. Can Earthly satellites help me in that sort of situation? Do the satellites have like a more stable runtime performance than a GitHub Action Runner might?
I would say that because of the caching, it can be a bit less consistent for that reason. Like, it depends on how much cache it would use on each run. So unfortunately, no, it will not be consistent, but I would say it's consistently faster, at least than the experience you're used to. So that I can say for sure. Most projects get 2 to 20x performance improvement, and that is like a game changer. It's not like an small incremental improvement. It depends on the setup and the specifics of each project. That's why there's such a wide range of like what we say is how much faster it is. But this is what our users report. So we have people that, get the full 20x of faster experience, and some people get 9x. A lot of people get just 2x. And I think even that is really remarkable when you think about it. It's like taking a build that's 40 minutes long and making it 20 minutes. Like, if you do that 10 times a day, that's basically your whole day. So we're giving you half a day back by doing that as a developer. So it's not necessarily more consistent, but hopefully it still helps with making it more useful for you.
You mentioned monorepo tools like Bazel or whatever we call it. does Earthly itself work with those monorepo tools, and does it work with like more JS based ones that aren't like as crazy as those other build tools?
Yeah, you can use them in conjunction. Oftentimes, Earthly is really good when you combine different programming languages. One problem with the way the language ecosystems have evolved is that they're very opinionated and they only work with that programming language. So like NPM and PyPy and Maven Central and Cargo will not work together in any shape or form, right? And there's no sort of standard tool you would use to put them all together if you wanted to just glue them together. And so people instead use, make files and bash files and maybe some Docker files and so on. But you have to sort of stitch that all yourself together. And the caching is very difficult to achieve. It's possible, but it's like incredibly difficult to get right. And while you're building those bash files, those make files and so on, you will run into these issues where it works one way on Linux, works a different way on Mac, and you will not find that out until your colleague runs it, and maybe you're asleep when they do because time zones and all that. So like all this complexity can get very annoying, right? And so what Earthly does is it is, of course, able to containerize all your builds, and therefore they run the same no matter where they run. So that addresses the consistency problem. But also in a monorepo setup, it helps with being able to only build the projects that you're working on and nothing else. So like if you have a complex integration test where maybe 7 microservices are being put together in a little setup, and you're only working on one of those 7 microservices, the build with Earthly will just reuse the cache for those other 6 and rerun only that single 7th microservice to build it, and then run the whole integration test with all of them combined. So these kinds of things are extremely difficult to do, to do right with like do-it-yourself sort of stitching together different tools. The monorepo tools that are more specific to an ecosystem don't work so well across other programming languages. A lot of people still use them within Earthly. So like you might use like a Turbo Repo or a Bazel within Earthly. We've seen that being done. Sometimes that's a good way to approach it. But a lot of times you might have just individual builds for each sub-project in your own very simple set up, like just NPM or Vite or whatever, and then stitch them together through Earthly. And that gives you a really good, very simple, but very consistent and fast setup.
That's pretty cool. This whole setup is really interesting. I'm trying to think of like what the process would be for going from, say, we have an existing CI infrastructure and, you know, maybe you're deploying CircleCI or GitHub Actions or something. You probably have some sort of containerization that's happening because those services are typically operating at container levels. And then you want to move to Earthly. So can you talk a little bit about like what the transition story is like? Like how does one person go from a traditional CI service to using your runners in their CI service?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing about the way CI services use containers is that I feel like they haven't gone all the way. So they use it only in the cloud, but they don't use it for the purpose of allowing you to run your builds locally, which is such a huge miss that, you know, it's such a big opportunity they had then and they did not take it. And so we bridged that gap. But to your question, the most typical way is taking your existing Docker files, which so many projects already have, just basically copy pasting them into the Earthfile syntax. So Earthfiles are these mix of Docker files and makefiles. We basically took the best parts of those two things and put them together and kept it really simple. So not none of the weird makefile stuff, just the simple stuff. Usually it's just a matter of copying your Docker file, putting it into the Earthfile instead, and then evolving from there. Usually that just gets you started and allows you to run your image builds in Earthly, but Earthly doesn't stop at images. So we also do regular artifacts, something like Docker files were never meant to do. You can output regular artifacts through containers, through Earthly, or run linters or unit tests or what have you. All of those being run through Earthly would be containerized, and that helps with the consistency and helps with wrapping up your setup in an environment that's very consistent. And so once you have that, you can just put it in CI and that's it. What people don't often realize immediately is that you don't have to stop there. The way Earthly works is that it integrates really well with other Earthly builds. So if you have another repository that is maybe somehow it's maybe a dependency of this repository and so on, you can just use Earthly to import things across. You don't have to think too much about, you know, which artifactory do I put this artifact? How do I download it later and so on? You can just import it from Earthly. And what importing means, it just says, I want you to build this other repo and then give me the result. And I want to use the result here. And because of containers and, you know, all this consistency, it doesn't really matter quite as much that it's running on your computer versus the CI. And because of caching, it's fast. And if you're using satellites, maybe a colleague of yours already built that other project, and so you're just using cache essentially. And this power of combining different projects together in a single build is where Earthly is really, really good. If you think about Docker files, they're typically more linear in structure. You do like this action and this action and this action, and then the caching builds up similarly, like linearly. With Earthly, you're able to do a much more complex setup where it's more like a graph instead of just one linear structure. So like you can have many projects and sub projects all leading into a feeding into a single bigger build or something like that. And it handles it really well through the caching and all that. And you don't necessarily have to start with that very complex setup, but just building the individual pieces initially gets you a lot of the value already.
Well, before we move on to talk about future stuff, given that I work at Oxide, I have to ask a very particular question. So you're self-hosting the runners, and then I know you can run Earthly just by itself without satellites. Do you have any like plans in the future for like an enterprise level? It's like, here, host your own satellites on your own infrastructure.
Yes, exactly. This is not official yet, but I will say, we are thinking about a self-hosted runner, like a self-hosted satellite that would be free to use, and so it's based on open source technology. So like, you can see the source code, you can play with it. Even today, you can even do that yourself, run it. You don't have all the features in there, but even today, it's people actually run it on their own. But we're gonna have like a fully supported version of that. And give you the benefits of having a control plane in the cloud to actually view and understand the way your satellites are running and how overloaded they are, or like, you know, having some basic ways in which you can monitor the situation. So there are plans. I would say not official, but I don't want to promise anything to anyone just yet. But it's a little glimpse of what's coming next.
What about some not so pie in the sky? What's next? Like, so what are you guys actually working towards next? What's on the roadmap?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things on our roadmap is something we call autoskip. It's a way for Earthly to quickly figure out whether you have any changes in that affect a certain CI/CD pipeline. And if nothing is affected, just completely skip that whole pipeline. So that is something that's coming up, and it's just taking some things that we're already fast at and making them even faster, basically. But actually, the more exciting part that we're working on right now, and it's going to take a little while for us to deliver it, but it's something we decided to focus on as a result of having more manpower from, you know, taking from Earthly CI into the rest of the stuff that we're working on. And so we have this thing that we call internally Compute V2. And it's this notion that, you know, because the way Earthly works and everything that you run is containerized, and it's basically a set of containers that just work together, and you have very clear dependencies between these different containers, we are able to take these different containers and run them distributed in a complex system. The next version of Earthly satellites will be a distributed version of Earthly satellites that uses the power of a compute cluster to deliver even faster builds. So we're thinking this will lead to a 10x improvement for very big projects in speed. So just another sort of order of magnitude in performance to really make a difference these things are possible through the way we've architected everything. Like from the very beginning, we were thinking, if your build no longer matters where exactly it runs, we could just distribute it automatically and make it really, really fast. And the result of that is that we would also use some distributed caching, and with the same benefits that you don't have to download or upload the cache, it's always there, always instant. That will make a really, really performant, high scale system that, you know, I imagine this would be used in big enterprises, and, you know, even not even in smaller teams, they're really useful to distribute your workloads and make them like really fast.
Sounds super cool. and a testament to what you guys have already built. So good luck with that. And one more question that I like to ask before we move on to tool tips, been asking it the past few episodes, is what's your spiciest dev take?
Well, it's something strange. So I believe that every developer should have a budget. And the reason is that the developers are the most expensive resource of a company. So looking at every tech company out there, usually it's just about 50% of the workforce are developers. And those developers are probably more expensive than other departments individually. And yet we are very stingy when it comes to what tools we give to these developers and what freedom we allow them to have. And I think that's kind of broken. Like, does it really matter that that developer buys a $20 tool from somewhere, like an IDE package or I don't know? If it makes their life easier and more productive, it's probably money well spent. Even if you waste maybe half of that, you know, half the time you're wasting the money, it's still, if you gain even 10 minutes of the developer time, that's still such a big win. And nobody's really thinking in those terms. And I remember from, I'm going to sound like a Google fanboy now, but back in my days at Google, like when I was using this MapReduce project, which I'm sure everyone is very familiar with, when you would run a very complex MapReduce job, it would at the end tell you how much that costs in terms of developer time. And it would be this massive, massive job going through, millions of queries that people searched on Google or something. And it would use 900 machines to do that and so on. And then every time, the result of how much compute cost that was such a tiny amount compared to the developer time. And that just put things into perspective, right? Like we're thinking about compute and, you know, budgets in general for the engineering organization in such a very strict manner. And we're not so strict when it comes to developer headcount necessarily, or like the time that the developers spend their time as. And so I don't know, I feel like that's an imbalance. We sort of have to fix that as an industry. So what we do here at Earthly is actually we give a credit card to every person in the company. So like, you know, everything is of course approved. Somebody reviews your charges, but you have the freedom to, you know, reasonably choose whatever you need for your work. And that's totally fine.
Yeah, I definitely think we're, for better or worse, sort of getting into course correction territory where people are like reducing headcount. We've seen that a lot across the industry and, you know, trying to, I don't know, in some ways trying to, I think, reverse, you know, it's like engineers in the industry have had a lot of salary power, I guess. And I think broadly the industry is trying to change that, which I have conflicted feelings about for sure. But to your point, don't skip on the things that like actually save you money. I mean, you know, yeah, that's a great thing. And most of the places that I've worked at have had some sort of budget. It's like, oh, you know, here's like a conference budget or a personal equipment budget or whatever. It's just like, yeah, you know.
Yeah. Those are great. Yeah. It's a start, you know. And if you think about how, you know, startups working towards creating better developer tools, they're going to get stuck on that problem that individual developers don't spend money. And I feel like if developers were more open to that, you know, the companies where those developers work were more open to that, there would be more ways for developer tools to launch themselves, and that will inspire innovation, that will create more opportunities. So yeah, I don't know. It's a interesting thing.
Nice. With that, let's move on to tool tips. Let me get that set up. Cool. First up, we have Burner, and I really like the font on this website.
Yeah, so I'm gonna write a blog post about this soon. I am a big fan of having the option of digital anonymity when it's necessary. So for example, you know, you're like perusing a new service. I was looking for an interior designer, someone just to like help me with my apartment a little bit. And I found a service and it looked interesting, but they requested all this marketing information up front. And I already have, I use Fastmail, and Fastmail can generate masked emails. So it's like a fake email. I use a service called privacy.com, which will generate a credit card or a debit card, I guess, for purchases that if you don't necessarily trust the place you're putting the card in, you can like cancel it or you can set limits. It locks it to the merchant. There's a lot of really cool properties with that. And then the sort of last thing is, you know, places ask for phone numbers, and it's like, I already get so many spam calls and everything. And it's like, there's got to be a solution to this. So there's a few out there. Burner is dedicated. If you get a year subscription, it's only like $3.99 a month. It's $4.99 if you do it monthly. So it's like super cheap, you know, if you just like have to put your number out there. There are other competitors too. So Mozilla actually has a service that will give you numbers and email addresses and maybe something else, which really surprised me. Oh, it's like a VPN service too, which that seemed cool. So if you want to support Mozilla and their commercial efforts, then that would probably be a good product if you don't use Fastmail or something else. But because I already had all these other services that I use and rely on, it's just like I just needed the phone thing. And it's on my first day using it, but so far so good. You know, I like being able to cancel it. And you get like text and calls and everything. I'm assuming it's just like a Twilio backend or whatever, but whatever. That's cool.
Yeah. I wish I had this tool maybe like 2-3 years ago. I currently have 1,000 unread text messages because of just random services thinking they can text and call me. The industry is in a bad state right now, that's for sure.
Oh yeah, same here. I made the mistake to put my phone number in a press release at some point with Earthly, and yeah, I regret that ever since.
Yeah, especially with those 2 million monthly visitors, that's a lot of people seeing that number.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I think this is the thing, like, we have a lot of hesitation about giving out contact info, right? And we shouldn't necessarily, you know, we should have the comfort to say, yeah, here, you can reach me at this. But like, that doesn't mean, you know, there's like this described intimacy of like giving someone your phone number that like, you know, maybe we could have it different. It's like, here's the phone number I give to friends and family, and here's the phone number I give to like marketers, and here's the phone number I give to like coworkers. And, you know, that world, I feel like, feels more sort of like equitable, and it feels like better because you don't have to make these really weird decisions. It's like, oh, do I know you enough to give you my number? Yeah, I don't know.
Tangential, but if you want a good telemarketing documentary, HBO Telemarketers just came out, 3 episodes. Amazing. It's crazy what they were doing. It's wild. Don't want to spoil it. My tool tip this week, my first tool tip, is a thing called AxeFlow. It was actually released last week under a slightly different name, but they named it just today. What it is a TypeScript library for easily interacting with LLMs, and it gives you stuff like streaming and hooks to use in your React code. So like where the OpenAI package has basically nothing in it and doesn't support any of this out of the box, or you might have to go to Vercel and try to use all the stuff that they've been building. This seems like all of that, but just in a third-party package that you could use anywhere and not be tied to their platform. So if you've been looking for something like that, I definitely give AxeFlow a look.
No shade to the developers, but the name was a weird choice because it tells me nothing about what it is.
Yeah, it was Axilla. So maybe they're course correcting slowly to a name that makes sense.
Again, no shade to developers if you're listening to this. I mean, I'm glad you released something. Naming is really hard. And 9 times out of 10, anytime I name something, I'm like, that was a really dumb idea.
You know, I wonder if APIs will become a bit different with streaming and LLMs. I feel like that's something that's not quite as standardized when it comes to, you know, like REST APIs and so on. There's no standard streaming component. I feel like we need a standard for that. I wonder if LLMs will change that for us or not. Keeping my fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. Like React seems like almost oddly poised to like take on the solution. Like it seems like a really good fit for like what they're doing at Vercel, like streaming the LLM responses and it all partially hydrating correctly. Like that just seems like a killer use case for like the built-in streaming that's in React. Next up, we have BuildKit.
Yeah, so this was my tooltip. BuildKit is the underlying technology that supports Docker files. We've been using it behind the scenes as part of Workly, actually. Over time, we became more popular in terms of like number of GitHub stars, if that's a metric you can actually rely on. But I think Bilkit takes all the credit for such an amazing, flexible piece of technology that allows you to define container builds. And even though it's much more tuned towards building images and not necessarily generic use cases like you would have in a CI/CD environment where you also have tests, you also have artifacts, and so on, we were actually able to mold it into the shape that we needed it to for Earthly. It's amazing in that it can do a lot of these sort of parallelism sort of things that you would have in a build, and this sort of complex build graph that you have within the build, where you can actually have different containers depend on each other and feed into each other as part of a build, and so on. And their architecture is such that you can define any what they call front ends. Basically, the language in which you specify the build can be custom. Like, you can code that up yourself, and the language results into an LLB, is what they call it. It's shown on the screen right now. And that LLB is maybe like a standard language that Bilkit understands to translate a set of instructions into builds. And so if you could build your own any language that you want and use that LLB representation in the middle to give it to Bilkit, and it'll build container images for you. The way it's been sort of described by the authors is that LLB is kind of like the IR or of LLVM. So in case you're familiar with compilers, that is. But basically, you can plug in any sort of language. You can make it translate into this LLB, similarly how you would translate a language into the LLVM IR, and then the rest of the system just knows what to do with it. This is built by the Docker team. It's not super well known, but it's powering Dockerfiles right now, and it's really cool. So definitely check it out.
That's super cool that you built Earthly basically just on the same dependencies as Dockerfiles. I love creating tools like that just to use the ecosystem.
Yeah, and it's also growing. So like all the feature sets that come, whenever something is improved in Bilkit, it gets improved in Earthly, and that's extremely useful because we do the same. Like, if we fix bugs in Earthly, we will fix them in Bilkit as well.
This is also a good shout out to just like learning about intermediate representations, IRs. So there's a lot more compiler work, especially happening in the front end world, and like understanding that having this intermediary layer actually makes it easy for a lot of other tools to leverage your sort of ecosystem. Definitely highly recommend more people to do that, take that approach.
Next up, we have the Boron Lander from. I'm not going to try to say that man's name. I'm sorry.
It's Mohit. I think it's Mohit Bhuiat. Yeah, something like that. Mohit is awesome. I love him as a creator. So he makes these sculptures. This one looks like a moon lander. And it's so awesome. These are like actual circuits or like actual electronic components. They do stuff. They can, I don't know if this one, some of them will like give you like, oh, what is the temperature? What is like, tell you something about the room. But Mohit does a lot of really, really interesting sculpture work. And they're all these sort of like raw electronics wires sort of in this sculpture like form. And I love them. This is one of my favorite artists. I consider them an artist. They're as much as an artist as an engineer, I suppose. But all the work from here looks amazing. And this is like a build plan for building your own. I think it's really creative and really unique. And I want to build one. So definitely, if you're looking for a new little side project that's kind of physical, but you don't want to try to do your own thing too much, like this build log is just beautiful, and it's well written, and there's so much detail here. And then you'll end it with like this really gorgeous piece of art that's both, looks nice and is functional and a great desk piece.
Yeah, this looks really nice. The Lego kid to electronics guy pipeline. I want to see the graphs on that, because this feels like adult Legos to me.
Yeah, for sure.
Nice. It always trips me when sculpture is not exactly, you know, chisel and stone kind of thing. But it's such an interesting, like especially functional art is really interesting, like a different sort of genre of its own.
I think there's so much crossover in the art and tech communities. I mean, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who are fully aware of this, but like as engineers, we are creating things. And if you don't break out and try any other mediums, I highly recommend that you do, because there's such a vast world out there and it'll scratch a lot of the same itch. And yeah, I don't know. I want more people making really interesting stuff like this. And if I could have every one of the things that Mohit has made on like a dedicated shelf, I totally would. I mean, they're all awesome.
Yeah, I'd buy one of these. They're all very nice. Okay. My last tool tip for the day, this came up on my GitHub activity viewer. Something I've been reading a lot about recently, but not haven't personally experienced, is that Datadog has very high prices. So this is an open source version of Datadog that is also a tenth the price at like all price levels. And it looks really nice also. So if you're in the market for a Datadog replacement that doesn't cost an arm and a leg to use, you might want to look at this.
Really cool. I'm glad alternatives exist. I'm always a little bit dubious of the claim. It's like, oh yeah, this will replace this open source tool will replace this like enterprise company that has all these features and does all this stuff and has all these people. But competition doesn't hurt, you know, if it can help drive down the price. I've heard some horror stories about Datadog bills that were just like massively insane.
Yeah. The fact that I can take this slider to a point where the monthly bill would be $40,000 is just a crazy number.
That's nuts. You know, when there's competition, the consumer wins. So that's awesome.
Totally. And, you know, it's one of those things, rising tide lifts all boats, right? So if they make a tool and they have some good features and Datadog steals it, then, you know, that's better for all of us. So,
yeah.
You know, so.
And on a long enough timeline, if we still continue to pick open source tools compared to non-open source tools, eventually everything is going to become open source to some degree. So I guess that's another good thing.
In my opinion, for sure.
Yeah, the world I want to see.
And with that ends the episode. Thanks for coming on, Vlad. This was a fun delve into all things alternate earthly CIs. So excited to see where you go with this.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on the show. It was really fun.
Yeah, thanks, Vlad. Also, I really appreciate the sort of business insights. It's really interesting to see how, especially we've talked a lot about how companies with open source components make money, and seeing the sort of transition, this phase that you've gone through, and the experience that you've had from previous startups. It's like really cool to hear that firsthand.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Thank you. We're learning and building.